They say winning isn't everything, but most of us would agree it's pretty nice. This week on the World Vision Report, a look back at some of the pieces from our show which have won awards over the years. We'll take you to Kenya, where starting school's a big deal at any age, even at 84. And in Ghana, it's a struggle to survive for many children who are slaves.
One day, one of the children was tired and he didn't want to work. The master hit the boy with a paddle until he jumped into the water and died.
And what happens when American Idol meets Middle Eastern culture? You get a national phenomenon called Afghan Star. We have our eyes on the prize. This week's World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. We begin our award show with a piece from reporter Prue Clark. Her story won both a Gracie Allen and a Gabriel Award. Prue traveled to Ghana to investigate child slavery there. Thousands of children are sold to fishermen who work in the villages that line the country's enormous Lake Volta. Work conditions for the children are brutal and dangerous.
The wind's blown up this afternoon, so work has halted in this tiny fishing village of mud brick houses on the lake's north shore. Children dressed in rags are making the most of the break. It's 2 p.m., and normally by now they'd already have done 9 hours' work, setting and repairing nets, hauling fish and preparing them for selling. The children labour on Lake Volta, the largest man-made lake in the world. The Volta River was dammed as part of a massive hydroelectric scheme 40 years ago. For Ghanaians downstream, it meant cheap electricity. But for generations of children, it spelt doom. These children must work 7 days a week, every week, under threat of being beaten or starved.
It's very hard.
13-year-old Neva spent 3 years enslaved to a fisherman who also owned his little brother and sister.
In the morning by 5 o'clock a.m., we went to fishing by 5 o'clock p.m.
We come back by 5 p.m.
If I eat, I don't satisfy.
Even when I eat, I'm not satisfied.
Sometimes if I done something wrong.
And if I do anything wrong, they beat me mercilessly, like I was a slave.
For Neva's services, the master paid his parents $100 a year. As shocking as it may sound, dire economic conditions here have pushed parents into selling their children into slavery. The toll on Neva is obvious. At 13, he's barely bigger than a normal 6-year-old. He's bright and good-natured, but he trembles when he talks of life on the lake. Little boys like Neva get the most dangerous job, freeing nets trapped deep beneath the water.
One day, we went fishing.
My master told me I should dive in there.
The master told me to dive into some very deep water.
I can't go there.
I can't go there.
And he beat me with
a paddle.
There's a nail in the
nail in the paddle, and it hit.
He shows me a 5-inch scar stretching up the inside of his arm.
It's not good for me to stay there. I want to be here.
Here is Neva's home village of Bakpa at the south of the lake, where he and his siblings, dressed in hand-me-down orange and brown uniforms, attend this local school. In a simple structure with a tin roof and no walls, excited children squash 2 to a desk. Neva came back here earlier this year after being freed, along with more than 500 other children, in a program run by the Geneva-based International Organization for Migration. IOM buys the children out of their contracts, returns them to their families, and pays to send them to school. Neva's case is typical. He's one of 21 children from his father's 5 wives. Having many children has traditionally been a point of pride for Ghanaian men, though they can rarely provide for them. Walking to Neva's house to meet his father, a man who sold his own children, I steel myself to meet a monster. But my Western mindset is useless here. I'm surprised that Napoleon Hadza is a gentle, sensitive man who says he now regrets having so many children and is pained at the choices he felt forced to make.
It's because of poverty. Well, things are, their school fees and
it is because of poverty their school fees are very difficult for me. So I had to send them to work for some people.
Hadza knows his children may never forgive him.
I apologize.
I gave them this explanation that it is not from my heart, but it's something that pains me to have done that.
And you would never do it again?
Oh, I would never do it again.
Gifty Dadzi was just 6 when her father leased her to a fisherman. 3 years later, she's tiny. Untreated typhoid has damaged her vocal cords. During her slavery, Gifty and 4 other children who worked with her lived in constant terror.
One day, one of the children was tired and he didn't want to work. But the master forced him to anyway. The master hit the boy with a paddle until he jumped into the water and died. I asked the master why he did that. He said that it should be a lesson for the rest of us.
I've come to a gegi on the lake's north shore to meet the master Gifty accuses of murder.
Getting out of this boat very carefully. I don't want to get too wet. I've got rubber boots on, but this lake is crawling with Bilharzia, which is a particularly nasty parasite that manifests itself in severe diarrhea, bloody urine. Of course, the children don't have any rubber boots, and 98% of them are thought to have this parasite. But people don't do anything about it. It's just a part of life here.
IOM's Eric Piazza is with me, and as we walk up to the village, scores of little children come out to watch.
All right, so you've rescued 537 children so far. How many do you think are left in these villages?
Thousands of them.
Thousands of them. If you look at the other side, you can't count them, but most of the children you see over there are all trafficked children.
We find Gifty's former master, Kofi Degenyu, outside his mud hut. He looks much older than his 48 years and he's gruff until I mention Gifty. Then he begins to shake uncontrollably.
And it's never, you've never had a child die?
No.
Have you ever had a child injured?
No. I don't want people to be saying that.
Eavesdropping villagers snicker at his denials. Piazza tells me the master's afraid a white woman asking questions might mean trouble. But there'll be no penalty for him. Piazza tells me no one's ever been charged in the frequent deaths of children here. Parents come and collect whatever money they're owed and don't ask questions. IOM's campaign to end child slavery has had a boost from an unexpected quarter. Overfishing has depleted the lake's fish stocks. Even with cheap child labour, few fishermen are making a living. And Eric Piazza says he has other reasons to be hopeful.
Through a little bit of education and awareness creation about what these children can do.
Through a little bit of education and a bit of awareness about what these children can do in the future and what harm this is causing the children, most of the parents are coming back to realize it is not good for the children.
At this point, few of the fishermen who relinquish their children to IOM go back to take another. This is Prue Clark on Lake Volta in Ghana for the World Vision Report.
Reporter Michael Kavanaugh was in the Central African country of Chad not long ago. He was there to interview refugees from neighboring Darfur who had fled the conflict there by the millions. Even though it's important for foreign correspondents to get stories from those remote areas, it's rarely easy. Michael sent us a reporter's notebook about the challenges he faced reporting from Chad. This report earned him a prestigious Edward R. Murrow Award.
I was on my way to a 9 a.m. meeting at the Gaga refugee camp in eastern Chad. This drive is supposed to take just over an hour, but I gave myself 3 because, well, this is Chad. There are only about 300 miles of paved roads in the entire country, and it was still the rainy season when a little precipitation can turn a dirt road into a thick soup in minutes. But I'd spent $200 on a driver and a Land Cruiser to avoid this problem, and when we set off, the forecast was clear. Then, about 30 minutes from the camp, the rain began.
This is Sam of getting stuck in the mud in Chad on the way to Gaga camp. By the time I started recording this, we'd been stuck in the mud for 2.5 hours.
Come on.
Technically, French is one of Chad's official languages, along with Arabic. But my driver, Abdullah, spoke as much French as he did English, which is to say, none. And none is exactly how much Arabic I speak. When he picked me up this morning, he'd looked like a sultan, in a flowing ochre robe and a bleached white turban. Once the car got stuck, his robes came off, and he turned into this skinny guy in gym shorts, madly digging before the giant 4x4 sunk too deep into the mud. We grunted at each other. I took off my shirt and started digging beside him. Whenever you think you're out in the middle of nowhere in a place like Eastern Chad, it's amazing how quickly someone finds you. Within 10 minutes, a half dozen kids from a nearby village arrived. Since they were all about the age when playing in the mud was still fun, they immediately jumped under the car and started digging.
Pousse. Un, deux, trois.
But the Land Cruiser wouldn't budge.
Not again.
Three women on mules rode by, laughing. They knew that for the amount of money I paid for my 4x4, I could have bought a dozen mules and rode one of them to the camp in 30 minutes. 5 hours later, we were still there, digging away. Finally, around 1 p.m, a worker from the refugee camp happened to pass by on his motorbike. I hopped on the back, covered in mud and looking like a refugee myself, leaving my driver and his gaggle of pint-sized helpers behind. Midway through my last interview at the refugee camp, my translator stopped me. Isn't that your car? He asked me in French. And from across the plains, underneath a cloud-filled sky that stretched for miles, came a speeding Land Cruiser. My Land Cruiser. As the car approached, it seemed a slice of sun shone through the clouds, and I laughed. I said one of the few phrases I knew in Arabic. God be praised. The difficulty of reporting from a place mired in poverty and conflict like Chad is that it's actually normal for things not to work. But what's most strange about a place like this is that things still usually work themselves out. Just never the way you planned.
Coming up on the World Vision Report, Afghanistan's own American Idol. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Every week, we bring you stories about the lives of people in the developing world. We're revisiting some of the best of those pieces this week in our award special. Next up, we take you to Afghanistan. There's been a lot of focus on elections there this year. But across Afghanistan, another kind of election has been going on via cell phone texting. The candidates aren't politicians. They're wannabe pop stars. That's a finalist on Afghan Star, an American Idol knockoff. The TV show has become a national phenomenon. 11 million people voted at the end of the first season. That's 1/3 of the population of Afghanistan. But not everyone approves. In this deeply religious society, some view pop music as sacrilegious. When the Taliban was in power, music was even banned. But for many Afghan youth, and 60% of the population is under the age of 21, music has become a symbol of freedom. Film director Havana Marking made a documentary about the show. It's called Afghan Star, and it took home awards at the Sundance Film Festival. Havana told us why she thinks the TV show has been so popular.
The Afghans are incredibly proud of their artistic, musical and cultural heritage, and for that to have been crushed for essentially a generation. People are desperate for this to be revived. They know how important it is, and this was an amazing opportunity for them.
How many people watched the finale?
11 million people, apparently, which is a third of the country. And if you consider that, I mean, it's incredibly poor and TVs are still a luxury. But in every village, you know, there will be one television in a cafe and people would come to the cafe to watch it. So it was a national phenomenon. It was amazing.
And it's really interesting how the people have taken to this form of democracy, voting by cell phone. I mean, how eager are they to vote?
It was a very interesting thing to watch. I mean, people were really, you know, debating who they should vote for and very excited to have a role and have an outcome in something that was a national phenomenon. I mean, these people that for 30 years, different regimes and different, you know, politics has been kind of forced on people with no one ever having a sort of say. And if you think that this is a sort of essentially a tribal elder society, the idea that a woman's vote is equal to a man's vote, or that people from the different ethnic groups, that all their votes are equal. That's and the age group, the young people's votes is as important as an old person's vote. So that's a very radical and very exciting thing for especially for the youth to take on board. I think it did, you know, one of the film's things that it does show is that I mean, democracy is flawed as well, and people start to buy SIM cards so that they can, you know, support their favourite singer by that. And of course, we can't directly buy votes in the West, but, you know, rich, powerful people can pay for advertising slots and pay for celebrities to endorse them and that kind of stuff. So there are flaws to it, but really it's been incredibly exciting for people to feel that they genuinely have an influence on the outcome.
Do you think it is because of the freedom to vote, or is it the bringing back of music, or what is it that makes it so wildly popular?
It's a combination of everything. The other sort of concept, you remember that there's still conflict going on, there's still danger there. To have something to talk about, to have something to watch is like an escape from the kind of reality of what they're living in is a, you know, very important factor to this kind of entertainment. It was a sort of, in a way, people were proving that there was a chance to have a normal life in Afghanistan at the moment. And this was a kind of demonstration of that. Plus, the Afghans were, as I said, incredibly proud of their musical culture. And this was a way of reinvigorating and being able to sing Afghan songs, seeing them performed by Afghan musicians. So that was very exciting. The other aspect of the reason why TV has been so successful there, there's a kind of unofficial curfew there. It's dangerous to go out in the evenings. There's no public spaces. There's no cinemas. There's no theatres. There's no community halls where people can meet and gather. So this was a form of entertainment that people can do safely within their own houses, so that people, extended families, will come together and meet and watch this show together.
Your film showed that it's not so safe for some of the contestants. In fact, one of the finalists was a woman, and when she was voted off, she actually moved a little bit, which some people considered dancing, and that actually put her life in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Sitara, who actually becomes the main character and who is the woman who dances, she is irrepressible. She is doing it for the love of music, and that she just wanted to dance and sing. And I think that she is inspiring for that reason, in that wherever you are in the world, however repressive the regime, there will still be people who are irrepressible. But yeah, the women, I mean, women have been killed for being on television in Afghanistan. This is not a new or sort of ridiculous idea. This is it's very dangerous.
What kind of response did she get when people first saw her on TV? And I'd like to know, just from regular Afghanis and also the Taliban, did they issue any threats? Was her life in danger?
Sitara's final performance, when she dances on stage, that is an electric moment, and people are absolutely shocked. I mean, you know, they haven't seen anything like it. And everyone here says, oh yeah, but, you know, well, she only danced a little bit. She dances enough, you know, it's definitely a dance, and that is the point. It's not a question of how much you dance or anything. The fact is, she dances. And this is still a very taboo issue. When it first happens, people are absolutely shocked. They haven't seen an Afghan woman do that on television. This is a sort of historic moment. How their shock turns is, you know, it sort of comes to be seen over the next few weeks. That shock could either go into kind of excitement that someone's done something different, or it can go to sort of horror. What happens is that it then becomes a more political issue, and local politicians start to take this on board and say that she's insulted their people, and you know, her, what she's done is appalling, and she, you know, essentially put a kind of unofficial death sentence on her. Then the local people in her town, you know, the young men really turn against her and say exactly that, that she's insulted their people, she's brought disrespect to all women from that region. And she really is fearful for her life. There's death threats, there's rumours all the time that she's been killed. Her family are absolutely terrified. It's an extraordinary thing that she goes through.
What ends up happening?
In the end, she's okay. She, her family are still incredibly proud of her, incredibly supportive. She goes home, and it's, you know, she survives. And I think, really, in modern terms, I mean, people here, I don't think, you know, understand just quite the seriousness of these events. The fact that she survives is a real sort of message of hope. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, she absolutely would have been killed. So this is progress. I mean, you know, you can laugh at that and say that it's bad enough that she had the threats. The fact that she survives, that is progress. And in fact, she is now, she's returned to Kabul. The heat is off her. You know, these things flare up and then they move on to other people. And she's now recording an album. She's singing at weddings. She's doing well.
Do you think the show itself and the fact that these women have stepped out, do you think it's changed anything in Afghanistan? I mean, is there no going back now?
I mean, obviously the show isn't a miracle, and it's not going to sort of change things overnight or be solely responsible for things. But it is definitely a tool in a sort of wide sweeping change that is happening. I think there's various aspects to its success and to its power. What this show does as well is it treats, again, all the ethnic groups completely equally. And, you know, that, again, is a very, very amazing and exciting thing for people to see. It doesn't make a big deal about it. It doesn't sort of, you know, just ethnic differences are just not acknowledged in that show, which is giving people a real vision of what a peaceful, united Afghanistan could be. And that is a very, very exciting thing for people, especially the young generation, to see.
Havana Marking, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Havana Marking is director of the documentary Afghan Star. You might have heard the statistics. 1 billion people around the world live on less than a dollar a day. But what does it really mean to survive on that little? Correspondent Suzanne Marmion won a Gabriel Award for this next piece. She spent 24 hours with a family in Malawi in southern Africa.
The Piri family lives across a two-lane road from a church. The family can hear the choir practice in between the sound of passing cars. 60-year-old Faisan Mavuli Piri ushers me into his mud brick house wearing a pinstriped shirt. It's second-hand, but it's neatly pressed. He's a dignified man, the father of 7 children with 3 still living at home. They'll be sleeping on the living room floor tonight. I'm in their room.
I think you appreciate the room. Sure, sure. And when you are here, please, I think you'll dream the dreams from America.
In the corner, there's a chicken. She'll be my perfectly polite roommate for the evening. In the morning, her rude friend will wake me up. The family keeps farmers' hours. We get up at 4:30 and dress. The Piris can only afford a few cheap shirts, trousers, and wraparound skirts. That cost averages out to 8 cents a day. We rush off to work in their maize field. For the past 3 years, the crop has failed because of drought. For subsistence farmers like the Piris, that means hunger. So several of Faisan Piri's brothers and neighbors have been giving him some money, about 63 cents a day, to help out. This year, though, the rains are better. Faisan and his wife are hoping for a bumper crop. Today, Betty Piri clears a section of her field, slicing a thick tree root with her hoe. As she works, her chiseled set of biceps flex under the sleeves of her striped blouse. She doesn't speak much English, but she giggles softly as I hold a microphone next to her. Betty and Faisan Piri are both 60 years old. Over the next 2 hours, they will literally work me into the ground. This year, the Piri family was lucky enough to receive free maize seeds through a government program, but they must buy fertilizer. That cost breaks down to 4 cents for the day. To Faisan Piri, it's an expense that's worth it. If the crops fail, they go hungry. And when they're hungry, he says, they can't work hard in the field.
That's why you have seen me now digging, hoeing here, because I've got energy and I ate yesterday.
You didn't eat this morning, though?
This morning, don't eat.
No, in the morning.
In the morning, no breakfast.
Okay.
Only we ate yesterday. That's enough.
The family will sometimes eat just one meal a day to stretch out the food. By 7 a.m., the sun is pounding on our heads as we work, and I'm ready to throw up. The good-natured Piris steer me to some shade and proudly declare the small portion of the field I've managed to work on as Suzanne's place. After a couple of hours, the sun is too much for everybody, and we head home. Along the way, we chop some palm fronds with a machete to tie a bundle of firewood. The Piris have no electricity, so this free fuel will be used to make an almost free lunch, prepared by the Piris' daughter, Martha. Back at home, the 18-year-old shreds some pumpkin leaves, which she's foraged herself.
We gather the leaves together. So start cutting. It tastes very delicious if you can add groundnut flour. But unfortunately, we don't have groundnuts. Mm-hmm.
She says this dish tastes very delicious with peanuts, but unfortunately, we don't have any. No peanuts, but there is salt. That costs 2 cents a day. And there's maize flour for making ensema, a staple dish similar to grits. That's 45 cents. The Piris have no running water, so Martha must collect it from a borehole well.
That is what we do. We draw water from the borehole, not from the tap, as you do in Lilongwe.
Yeah. Lilongwe is the country's capital and my home. My family frets over my troubles there with power outages, malaria, and spitting cobras. But Martha's right. Compared to the village of Lafitzi, it's the lap of luxury. Martha encourages me at the pump.
You have more power.
But then the hard part is carrying that thing. I don't doubt I can't even lift it.
This is the moment I've been dreading, when I'm supposed to put a galvanized steel bucket filled with water heavy as cement on my head. I can't even lift it more than a few inches off the ground. As I lamely offer to get the next one, Martha heaves the full bucket onto her head.
Oh, Martha!
Martha carries water this way 5 times a day. The family also has 2 brothers who live at home and herd goats and operate a bike taxi service that brings in some money. But one of them needs school fees that come to 10 cents each day. So Martha sometimes buys and resells sugar cane to the neighbors as a snack. That earns the family 4 cents a day. It's not the career she envisioned when she graduated from high school. She'd like to be a news anchor, or as they're called here, news readers.
I do admire the news leaders. Especially those in TVs.
Do you have a television?
No.
No TV and very likely no money ever to send Martha to train to be a news anchor or anything else. Martha's father says if he did ever have extra money, the first thing he'd like to do is fix up his crumbling mud brick and plaster house. To pass some time on this hot day, he gives me a tour of his home.
When I put the plaster, it looked very, very beautiful. But now, as you can see, it's not very beautiful. It's an old house.
His son, Jack, has covered some holes in the corrugated iron ceiling with packing tape.
That one is very clever.
Meanwhile, the women spend the afternoon preparing a special dinner. Martha slips out to the market to buy some local fish. At mealtime, her father humbly offers the small fish to me.
You forgive us for the fish, small ones.
Mr. Piri asks my forgiveness because the fish on our plastic plates are so small. They're like a little pile of guppies. But the smell is driving the Piri's cat wild. The fish were 35 cents, and that broke the bank. I'm pretty sure the Piris bought the fish as a treat for me, but they wouldn't admit it. I couldn't eat the extravagance, even though I was worried about refusing Martha's smiling hospitality.
Have you tasted the fish?
I'm just really, honestly, not that hungry.
I was too touched by what they'd done, and a kind of sad anger had started to settle in the pit of my stomach. This family worked so hard, but has so little. On this day, combined with money spent on lamp oil and soap, the family's expenses have hit $1.25, but the day's income was just 94 cents. That includes 7 cents the family earns from selling some cotton they grow themselves. So today, in the small mud brick house across the street from the church, the 5 members of the Piri family each lived on a quarter. It was still too much. They'll have to live on less tomorrow. For the World Vision Report, I'm Suzanne Marmion in Lafidzi Village, Malawi.
You can find a slideshow of Suzanne Marmion's day with the Piri family at our website. The address is worldvisionreport.org. Coming up on the World Vision Report, we go south of the border and back again with award-winning musician Leela Downs. Stay with us. Árboles de la barranca porque no han enverdecido es que no los han regado con agua del río Florido. Me puse a amar a un hombre así con la ilusión de amar. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. A few years ago, reporter Eric Whitney traveled to Kenya to cover that country's attempt to overhaul its education system. There was a lot of optimism in the air, especially from new students. But no one was more excited than Kamani Maruge, the oldest first grader Eric Whitney met on his trip. Eric won a New York Festival Gold Award for this story.
Kapken Uwiwo Primary School is a busy place. Jane Obinchu, the head teacher, runs down the number of students in each class.
Wow, like in class 1 we have 116, class 2 we have 220, so each teacher has 110. Class 3 we have 150 with 2 teachers, and from class 4 we have about 70 per class, so it's quite a big number.
The number of children has more than doubled since last year, when Kenya's government began offering free education through the 8th grade. More than a million students, like these, who had been unable to pay $60 a year for their uniform, books, and tuition, showed up, eager to learn. Now, this classroom, built out of scrap wood at Kapken Uwiwo, is overflowing with first graders. They have to share desks, and some take in the day's lessons sitting on the floor. It's a mixed age group, because many older kids who couldn't afford school before are just now getting started.
Very good.
The oldest student, by a long shot, is Kamani Maruge. He's 84 years old. He never got to go to school as a child because his parents needed his help on the family farm. Now, he's excited about finally being able to learn how to read.
One major reason of going to school was he has been going to church, and when he goes to church, they read the Bible, and he doesn't understand. So he would like himself to read by himself and understand what the Bible says.
But when Mr. Maruge first tried to enroll in school, the teachers didn't know what to do with him. Mrs. Obinchu thought it was some kind of joke.
We didn't take him seriously. Then we told him, here we have pupils who are 6 years old in class 1, and we take children in uniform. Not, you know, we were just saying things. We were telling him things to put him off. And he said no, he was serious. We told him, we thought he was wasting our time.
Mrs. Obinchu quickly learned otherwise. Mr. Maruge came back, wearing the required uniform, short pants, a blue sweater, and gray knee socks, the same color as his beard. The teachers tried to put him off again, but Mrs. Obinchu says he was determined.
Come the following week, he was here again very early in the morning, and this time plus a bag and exercise books in it.
Teachers tried to talk him into taking adult literacy classes, but Mr. Maruge wanted to learn, he said, like any other child. Finally, school officials relented, touched by his desire to read the Bible and know how to count his money.
So we thought this was something very simple. So we discussed as a staff and agreed to assist him.
8 months later, Mr. Maruge is proud to share biblical passages with visitors. Sitting in his mud-walled house with a dirt floor, he reads from the book of Luke.
Luka mutakatibu. Kuleta amani.
There'll be some differences between a father and a son. And also there'll be some differences between the mother and the daughter.
Despite his age and the need of a hearing aid, teachers say Mr. Maruge is progressing quickly. At first, they say, it was a distraction for the other students to have a senior citizen in class. But they soon got used to it, and now they like having him around. For his part, Mr. Maruge doesn't mind being the oldest student at the school. Far from it.
He decided to come to the school because he likes young children. So he would like to stay with young children because now his age is now young. Yeah.
And Mr. Maruge is planning to live a long time so he can attend university and become a veterinarian. The teachers chuckle at this, but Mr. Maruge says he's surprised them before and he just may do it again. In the meantime, he's inspiring other adults in Kenya to enroll in school. For the World Vision Report, I'm Eric Whitney in Eldoret, Kenya.
Entre copa y copa se acabó mi vida, llorando borracha tu perfido amor.
For years, singer Lila Downs has bridged the gap between Mexico and the United States. Lila was born in Oaxaca to a Mexican Indian mother and a Scottish American father. As a child, she lived between homes in the mountains of Oaxaca and Minneapolis, Minnesota, where her father was a professor. Lila still calls both countries home, and her music still crosses both borders. The Grammy Award winner and Oscar nominee spoke to us from New York City. She told us her childhood was a little unusual.
Well, I really grew up always crossing the border, you know. One year, since I was born. So I was very fortunate, but that was also a challenge, you know, kind of feeling like you didn't belong. You know, people ask you, well, where are you from? What do you, you know, that's the constant question. And feeling like you're from three different things, it was always a long story.
Three different things being American, Indian, and Mexican?
Yes.
And so has this influenced your music, Lila?
Definitely. Kind of trying to bridge those cultures, kind of trying to bring people together, you know, people from the U.S. who sometimes didn't know very much about Mexican cultures, you know, the diversity that we have. And also in Mexico, a lot of ignorance about what it means to be North American. You know, all we are is eat hot dogs and hamburgers.
Is that what they think?
Yeah, pretty
so,
much.
So you try to bridge that divide.
I try to. And, you know, we've been incredibly fortunate. We get to do music, which is already a gift.
Some of your songs are very light and sound indeed like songs you'd hear in a cantina, but others are more soulful and serious. I'd like to listen to one of those. Let's listen to Agua de Rosas, and then we can talk about that.
Suripanta del pueblo, la mujer que más quiero, que me das de beber. Agua de rosas, dame de beber.
What is this song about?
I grew up in a very small village in Oaxaca, and kind of being independent was frowned upon, I guess. So it's been an issue for me. My father died, the North American part of my family died when I was 16, and therefore my mother and I were left alone. I'm an only child. So suddenly people like stopped speaking to us just out of I don't know what. And then I've kind of figured out that there was no man in the family anymore. So suddenly the dynamic changed. So really the song is about kind of appreciating independence and women who are strong in spite of this element of discrimination.
You know, probably the biggest issue that comes to mind when Americans think about Mexico is immigration. And I'm sure you've looked at immigration from the perspective of both sides of the border. I'm wondering if you've written any music about this thorny issue.
You know, I was working in Oaxaca at one point, and these people would come into the store who had worked in the U.S. and had crossed the border. And one time, a man came and asked me to translate this death certificate because his son had died in the intent of crossing the border. And I wrote a song about this incident called Ofrenda, which is on our first album called Sandunga.
En el camino pa'l norte, un tecolote me habló. Me dijo, muchacho de nube, ¿por dónde dejaste tu amor? Le dije que dice.
Ah, and what do you say in the song?
It's dedicated to those people who have passed, and the lyrics speak about, well, when I die, please send back my body to the patron saint of my pueblo, of my town, of my village, and dedicate my death to him, because all I was trying to do is work for my people.
Let's turn to some of your lighter subjects, like your song about cooking. Now, the words to this song we're about to play describe a recipe for mole sauce.
Yeah.
Let's play a little of that.
You first need to get the peanuts. You get the salt and the bread. You grind and you fry the chilies. You boil the chocolate. Get cinnamon and banana. Get cloves and oregano. Get thyme and the blackest pepper. You grind it in Mexico.
Is this song really about mole sauce, or is there something more to it?
Yeah. Well, it's really, you know, dedicated to those amazing women that cook. There's this cook called Abigail Mendoza, and she's from the Valley of Oaxaca, and she does the mole in the old way, meaning she grinds all the elements, the chiles and the spices and the fruit and everything on the stone. And then, of course, the mole has a very particular flavor.
Now, Lila, you married an American musician, and you still live part of the time in the U.S. You're in New York now, but part of the time you're home in Oaxaca. So where
That's
do
right.
you consider home?
Well, really, both places are home. And I guess that I'm more rooted in Oaxaca in the sense that it's more of a spiritual center for me. But then, for me, it's a challenge to bring Anglo audiences, especially to Latin, I guess, forms of aesthetic. And sometimes, you know, Anglos have this vision that we are just these dramatic people, which is partly true. but that's what's beautiful about the culture. And what I'm trying to do in our songs is to make people feel that somehow, to relate, even though you can't speak the language. It's really cool to try and understand those differences and not turn your back on them.
Lila Downs, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Borrachita de tequila llevo siempre el alma mía.
Lila Downs is an award-winning musician. Her latest album is called The Very Best Of. She joined us from New York City.
Por ese querer
mañana tendré un trago de tequila. Tequilera, como si fuera de pila.
Correspondent Conrad Fox has also spent years in Mexico. His travels often took him to southern Mexico. That's where he followed Central American migrants trying to get to the U.S. Conrad's reporter's notebook about their dangerous journey was a winner at the New York Festival.
Behind a piece of tin sheeting on a side street, a dozen or so migrants huddle in the dark. Tomorrow, they'll try to jump onto a northbound train. So they spend the night here, just a few feet from the train tracks. They look like desperados at first sight, but when you get to know them, they seem more like an extended family. A couple of girls in the group make tomato tacos, which they serve to the others. For many, it's the only thing they'll eat today. The younger ones laugh and dance to the sound of a distant stereo. There's 22-year-old Ebert from Honduras, who's going to write a book about his trip. And there's 50-something Filiberto, a hardened, sunburnt veteran of this route. He's also from Honduras and has seen some terrible things on these journeys, like exhausted companions falling under the wheels of trains. But the jolly wrinkles around his eyes and his soft voice hide it all. He's kind of a mentor to the younger ones. But Filiberto has someone special to look out for on this trip. He's traveling with his 17-year-old daughter. He tried to talk her out of it, but she insisted on coming. She wanted to see her mother, who lives in the U.S. The next day at the train depot, about 150 migrants wait for a train. One starts up as they gather by the tracks, stretching, arranging backpacks. There's a tense atmosphere now as the train builds up steam. "Where's Filiberto?" Ebert, the 22-year-old, asks, with concern. There he is, strolling casually towards us, his daughter beside him. The train is almost upon us now. And suddenly, it's every man for himself. Without warning, Ebert shakes my hand and is off running. Others stream past, racing for the ladders attached to the ends of the cars. In the fray, they bump each other to grab a free spot. Ebert swings himself up, just as a signpost skims past his head. Filiberto hoists his daughter up onto a ladder as it passes by them and runs alongside her. She's grabbed the lowest rung, but then one hand slips, and her legs swing wildly under the carriage. Her father still holds the hem of her t-shirt, trying to keep her legs away from danger, but the train is now moving faster than he can run. The shirt stretches and stretches. She tries to hold onto the ladder, but she's losing her grip. "Let go," her father cries, and then she falls. With one determined movement, he swings her away from the wheels of the train. They get up again, running together alongside it. But it's going too fast. The last car sails past, just out of reach. Yet, they continue to run. And now, there's no one else left on the tracks except them, running hand in hand behind a train they'll never catch.
Conrad Fox was our Mexico correspondent. He now lives in Canada. If you'd like to see a dramatic photo of Conrad's story, just go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. And while you're there, you can download a complete podcast and take us with you. And that's it for this week. You can follow us on Twitter, or you can become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook, where you can get a sneak peek of our upcoming show Friday afternoons. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.